is China Law and Policy, and welcome to our podcast. In the past 65 years, the People's Republic of China has come a long way from the way it once portrayed itself in propaganda posters of the 1950s. Class struggle is long gone, and communal property is on its way out. But as Leta Hong Fincher, a former award-winning journalist and doctoral student in sociology at Tsinghua University in Beijing, makes clear in her new book, Leftover Women, The Resurgence of Gender Inequality in China, another key icon from that period has all but evaporated: the strong, independent, working woman. Instead, in its place has emerged well-educated, urban women pressured to marry young at all costs, including missing out on one of the largest accumulations of wealth in Chinese history. After 50 years of ostensibly promoting women's rights, the Chinese government has backtracked and has allowed, even encouraged, traditional gender roles to resurface and take hold in Chinese society. To understand more of this phenomena in more detail, Ms. Fincher is joining China Law and Policy today to discuss her book, Leftover Women, and the new roles for women in Chinese society. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the title of your book, Leftover Women. Can you explain more what this is, when the concept first came about?
Yeah, the term leftover women, or sheng nu, was defined by the All China Women's Federation in 2007 to mean an urban, professional woman over the age of 27 who's still single. And the same year, China's Ministry of Education adopted the term as part of its official lexicon. And ever since 2007, China state media has really very aggressively disseminated the term through its news reports and columns and commentaries. And you also see a lot of cartoons really insulting single, urban, educated women in their 20s. Basically sending the message that these women are too ambitious, they should stop focusing on their careers, and they should instead look for a good husband before time runs out and they remain single forever.
So you mentioned the state-run media promoting this, and that also this was a term created by the All China Women's Federation, which is a state government-backed organization. So is this an intentional concept that the Chinese government is pushing on women, and if so, why?
Yeah, I think there's no question that it's a deliberate campaign. If you look at the news reports that Xinhua put out in 2007 and 2008, there are quite a few of them that reappear over and over and over again over the years and are still reappearing even in 2013 with only slight changes in the wording, and maybe they'll change the picture. So there's no question that the propaganda department wants to get these reports out and is pushing them out continuously. When I looked into the origins of the term, I noticed that in January 2007, China State Council issued a population decision, which was a very important statement about what they called unprecedented population pressures facing China, in part because of the sex ratio imbalance, which they described as a real threat to social stability. And they said that China has a problem of so-called low quality of the population, which would make it very difficult for China to compete in the global marketplace. And so they set a key goal of so-called upgrading population quality. And this term, population quality, or 素质, can refer to a complex mix of superior genetic makeup, education, a more nurturing environment. And so the women who are being targeted in this leftover women media campaign are precisely the women who are considered to be of highest quality. So I argue that this campaign is in part an effort to get these highest quality, so to speak, women to marry and have a child for the good of the nation.
Huh. So, in your book, I mean, you talk about the leftover women, and then you tie that concept to the current property market, and you argue basically that, you know, they end up, because of the fear of being left over, the women end up losing the opportunity to gain from one of the largest accumulation of wealth in Chinese history, which is basically the current urban real estate market. Can you explain that tie a little bit clearer?
Yeah. Well, first of all, there are a lot of complicated dynamics that go into home buying in China. So marriage is inextricably connected to home buying in contemporary China. Along with very intense marriage pressure, there is also intense pressure to buy a home. The norm is that the man is supposed to be the official home owner. And there's a lot of propaganda, again, and real estate developer advertisements and online matchmaking advertisements, all perpetuating the notion that a man must own a home in order to attract a bride. And they also spread the notion that Chinese women will refuse to marry a man unless he owns a home. So one of the consequences of this is that Chinese parents tend to only buy homes for their sons and not for their daughters. So women are shut out of property accumulation, first of all, because their parents tend not to support them in any way. And these homes are too expensive for young people to buy on their own. So if your parents are not helping you, then you're really stuck. So the women that I've interviewed who are in their 20s and are have a boyfriend and they're thinking about marriage, they often will take their life savings and transfer it to the boyfriend to finance the purchase of a home, which is then only registered in the man's name. And when I ask these women, who are extremely educated and very, very intelligent and sophisticated, and they actually want economic independence, and they say that they actually want to own their own home, but then I ask them, well, why, when you're buying this marital home, why aren't you putting your name on the deed? And a lot of them say that it's simply because they're at the age where they're considered left over, which can start as early as even before 25 years old. Some women can already start feeling that way. So they're very anxious to get married. Their own parents are pressuring them to get married. They're certainly coming under a lot of pressure from the media, and they're coming under pressure from their teachers, the educational system, and their own doctors, who tell women in their 20s that they really need to have a child in their so-called best child-rearing years, which is before the age of 30. And the rhetoric is, and even doctors tell them that if they wait until past 30 to have a child, their child will have a birth defect. So there's intense pressure on these women to marry because they genuinely believe that time will run out for them. So these women, when it comes down to it, are very often unwilling to walk away from an unequal financial arrangement, even if they really want that. And in most cases, they do want equality. But the pressures against them are just so intense.
I mean, I guess, like, in reading your book, I mean, that was the hardest part for me to understand. And that you have these very well-educated, I mean, that most of the women you interview are at least college-educated, if not PhDs, very urban, sophisticated. They seem like this modern woman. I mean, it just seems so hard to comprehend that they are, that you have so many so willing to give up their equal economic rights in a relationship because of this concept. I mean, is it just this media? I mean, how, I guess if you can talk more about how strong this media campaign is, or is it also something with the education system itself that women aren't questioning some of this propaganda? Because I just think if you were in a Western country, I mean, there would be more questioning of it. I guess if you could talk more about that.
Well, it's certainly not just, I mean, I talk about the Leftover Women campaign. But when it comes to home buying, that's simply one factor that's shutting women out of property ownership. The fact that homes are so expensive is a huge factor as well. If homes were not so expensive, then these women would be able to save up enough money on their own, and they would. Most of the women I interviewed wanted their own homes. So if they were able to afford it on their own, they would buy their own homes. So part of it is China's privatization of housing and the subsequent real estate boom has created these tremendous new pressures on everybody in Chinese society, on the parents, on men and women. Even if the woman actually transfers her life savings over to the man to finance this home, usually the man's family still ends up putting in more money than she does, simply because the man's parents have been saving all their lives. So then it may come down to the fact that the man's family says, well, we put in more money, therefore you have no right to put your name on the deed. It may be the man's parents who are really fighting with her, and maybe her boyfriend would support adding her name to the deed. But it's a very complicated transaction involving extended families pitted against each other. But because of this fear that women over a certain age in their mid to late 20s are not going to be able to find a husband, it often winds up being that the parents of the daughter may actually help her finance the purchase of the home, but they don't want the daughter to insist on adding her name because they're afraid that her boyfriend or fiancé will walk out on her. So even the parents of the daughter are urging her to stop being so assertive and not to fight with the boyfriend and to just give in. And in fact, a lot of these young women, again, argue a lot. They can get into very heated arguments with their fiancés over the issue of putting their name on the property deed. So it's not as though they just blindly go into it and willingly give away all of their money and don't think about it. Although that said, there are some women who do that. But it's just a multi-layered form of discrimination against women. And it also has to do with state regulations on the purchasing of property. So, for example, one woman I interviewed who was a PhD candidate, extremely educated, she desperately wanted her name on the property deed, but her boyfriend and her own parents were telling her that it's not worth putting her name on the deed because then if they want to buy a second home, then they would have to pay a much higher down payment. So that was the reason she gave for leaving her name off the deed, but she felt very bad about that. And then when I asked her, well, can you afford to buy a second home? Are you going to buy one? And she said, well, no, we can't afford to buy it. So there are just many layers of obstacles for these women.
And just to switch gears a bit, you mentioned in your book some of the laws and that impact this, and you discuss that the Supreme Court's 2011 interpretation of China's marriage law, and you basically argue that this interpretation, which in cases of divorce only allocates property to those whose name is on the deed, absent some exceptions, denies women even more rights in the property market. I guess, can you give a little bit more background on this interpretation, and also do you have any background on what caused the Supreme People's Court to issue this interpretation?
So effectively, the marriage law was originally a real cornerstone of the Communist Revolution, and it gave women rights to property, the right to divorce, all sorts of new rights. And over the years, actually, women's rights to common marital property were strengthened. But in 2011, with this new judicial interpretation, effectively, if the woman is unable to prove through legal financial receipts that she put in a certain amount of money towards buying the home, she's not entitled to that home in the event of a divorce. None of the women that I interviewed kept any receipts of their financial contributions to the homes. And moreover, money is fungible. So there are many ways in which women's, if they're working women working for pay, there are many ways in which their pay is supporting the household.
Right.
And the man's money may be going directly to paying off the mortgage, so there's a receipt that for the man's contribution to the home. This law is really detrimental to women's property rights. Now, what I've heard anecdotally, I wasn't specifically researching why the court issued this new judicial interpretation, but what I've heard anecdotally from some lawyers is that the court was deluged with letters from parents of men who wanted to protect their sons when they got married. They didn't want the wives of their sons to have any share in the home, because the parents tend to put up so much money to buying these homes for their own sons. And because of China's rapidly rising divorce rate, I've also heard that the court simply wanted to simplify divorce rulings, just get these cases through the court fast. And so... But it's been an incredibly controversial interpretation, and a lot of women across China are very upset about it, but there's no organized movement to protest it, because organizing protests is so difficult.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess in looking at the Supreme People's Court interpretation and how that has a negative impact on women, I mean, one of the things, though, that has happened recently is that there has been, I mean, China has had its first gender discrimination lawsuit in employment, and I mean, that seems like a positive development in terms of women's rights. So how do you gel the fact that in a country where the court can reject cases, so they allowed, obviously, this case to be heard, and even though it was settled, they did allow it, and it's been published in the newspaper. How do you gel that kind of a development with something like what's happening with the leftover women and the 2011 marriage law interpretation?
Well, I mean, Chinese society is certainly not static, and there are some legal successes. I mean, that gender discrimination lawsuit was very important, and it set an important precedent. But the fact is that there are so many other systemic ways in which women's rights and gains have been really reversed in the past two decades. And one successful lawsuit here or there doesn't fundamentally change the situation for the vast majority of women. Most notably, there is still no specific law on domestic violence, and feminist lawyers and activists have been lobbying for over a decade to pass a law, and they've drafted the language, it's all ready, but it simply hasn't been passed.
To go back to that, because your book ends where you do discuss some individuals that are trying to change a little bit incrementally, but I have to admit that it didn't seem like there was going to be a lot of change from them, even though they're brave in what they're doing. I mean, it sounds like, based on what you say, you don't see a lot of change happening soon, but I mean, is that correct? Or if you do see any change, where do you see it coming from?
Yeah. I certainly don't see change coming from an organized nationwide women's rights movement, simply because the political atmosphere is just too severely oppressive for that to happen. But what does give me hope is that individual women can make choices in their own lives to avoid getting trapped in a very discriminatory system. For example, there are women in their late 20s who have told me that they refuse to ever get married because marriage is a bad institution for women in China. And they see this as an empowering choice. That doesn't mean that they are never going to have a lover or boyfriend, or maybe they're lesbian. But there are individual ways in which women can act to empower themselves. But once they enter the institution of marriage, it's very, very difficult. Marriage as an institution doesn't protect women's rights. So I actually see it's contrary to the myths that are spread by the propaganda, the state media, that single women in China are extremely miserable and lonely. I see the reverse, that single women are the ones who tend to do better. They may, you know, they don't have husbands holding them back, telling them what to do. They have a lot more freedom. Women who are married, if there's any problem at all in the marriage, they're extraordinarily vulnerable.
Right. And just in closing, I mean, your book is a fascinating book, and I do recommend it for everybody to read, especially if they really want to understand China today, women in China today. But why do you think the rest of the world should be paying attention to this issue, if at all?
Well, the thing is that let's put aside the issue of fair treatment for women. Obviously, women are being treated unfairly in China and being discriminated against. But as an economic issue, it's very important. China's obviously becoming increasingly a driver of global economic growth. And the fact that women are basically being told by the government that they should stop working so hard and return to the home is going to end up having very damaging long-term economic consequences for China. There's already a declining labor force participation among women, particularly in the cities, according to the latest census results. There's a dramatically widening gender income gap. And when women are hurt, these are the most talented women in the country, and if you're telling the most talented female workers in China to just, it's okay, just leave the workforce, that's going to hurt China's economy. And of course, if China's economic development is hurt, if it's destabilizing, that's going to affect the rest of the world. So it's something that the rest of the world should be interested in.
Right. All right, well, I want to thank you again for spending time with China Law and Policy. And just so our readers know, Leftover Women, the Resurgence of Gender Inequality in China, that can be purchased at Amazon.com. Thank you again.
Thanks so much for having me.